This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For months, the pace of the Democratic presidential campaign seemed glacial. After the Iowa caucuses on Monday, it suddenly looks like an avalanche. On Tuesday, we begin a rapid succession of primaries that will give the candidates little time to reposition themselves or switch resources from state to state. Iowa also triggered a seismic shift in the field as Senators Kerry and Edwards overtook frontrunners Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt. Congressman Gephardt dropped out of the race. The first primary in New Hampshire could be another surprise. Two candidates who skipped Iowa joined the race, retired General Wesley Clark and Senator Joe Lieberman. A little later in the program, Senator Lieberman joins us to talk about his campaign and take your questions. If you'd like to join us, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Until then, we'll talk about the race in New Hampshire in general and the Lieberman campaign in particular with Joe Klein, a senior writer with Time magazine, and Andrew Smith, a professor of political science and director of the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire. Joe Klein is at NPR's production facility in Manchester, New Hampshire. Nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be back, Neil.
A couple of weeks before the caucuses, you told me in Iowa that nobody here has any idea of what's going on. You certainly turned out to be right about that. Do you have any better idea what's going on in New Hampshire?
Maybe a little bit. John Kerry seems to have resumed the position he had a year ago here, which is the neighbor everybody knows and many people respect. And his experience and especially his expertise in national security issues have held him in good stead, especially because of the contrast with Governor Dean, who has had one of the more unfortunate weeks in probably the history of American politics.
Let's focus on that for just a minute. And Governor Dean, of course, finished a surprising third in the Iowa caucuses, a distant third, and then followed that with a speech to his supporters in Des Moines, which is has puzzled a lot of people ever since. As you've gone over that, I'm sure you've done some reporting on this. What was his plan? What was he thinking?
Well, that's a very good question, and you can't know for sure, but it seems to me that when you look at the way he came out onto the stage that night, high-fiving Senator Tom Harkin, who was one of his big supporters, and pumping fists and things like that, what he had in his mind was Bill Clinton's performance here in New Hampshire in 1992 when he lost to Paul Tsongas, came back and declared himself the comeback kid for finishing second, and got out of town. And a lot of people since have mythologized that performance as the most positive way to spin a losing night. I think that Howard Dean tried to do that, but without any modulation at all. This has become, within a matter of days, the stuff of legend. I mean, David Letterman did a bit last night on, showing Dean giving the speech and then his head exploding. Even on NPR, Good Gray NPR yesterday, this was called the Howard Dean I Have a Scream speech.
On that radical afternoon evening program, not certainly
that's right.
Talk of the Nation.
No.
But this
that program goes overboard all the time.
Absolutely. But in adjusting to this new situation, I mean, has the Dean campaign, they've been trying to ratchet it down. I mean, they've been trying to tone the candidate down.
Well, he's had a rhetorical lobotomy today and yesterday and today. And I don't know whether that works because it doesn't fit his personality. It's really going to be very hard for him to reinvent himself at this point. But, one of the most important qualities, the most important quality in a president is to have someone who doesn't seem like a nutcase. You want to have someone who seems very solid, very patient, able to negotiate, intricate details of treaties and things like that. And Howard Dean has left an indelible impression now that he's not that kind of guy. It's an unfortunate misimpression because he's not a nutcase. But I think it's going to be very, very hard for him to overcome.
Now, how have the other campaigns adjusted, tweaked their messages since leaving Iowa?
Well, I think that that there are a couple of interesting cases here. John Edwards is looking for some small sort of bounce here in New Hampshire, but he's really looking toward next week. And I think we're beginning to see, it's very interesting today, we're beginning to see the first signs of a real rivalry between General Wesley Clark and John Edwards to become the Southern candidate. I think that that battle is going to play itself out in South Carolina next week. It's an interesting struggle. You're beginning to see the two of them badmouth each other in quiet ways. General Clark has suffered a little bit here because he was the resting place for a lot of the people who thought John Kerry had no prayer of winning this nomination, and that moved his polls up here. And now apparently, you know, it seems that a lot of those people are deserting him back to John Kerry, who seems like a winner. But this is incredibly volatile, and this is the longest week in American politics. And we have a big debate tonight, and it'll change. The situation will change three times between now and next Tuesday.
That debate broadcast from St. Anselm's College there, and I think it's going to be nationally broadcast on Fox. Let's bring Andrew Smith into the conversation. Again, he's a professor at the University of New Hampshire, director of the Survey Center there, and good to speak with you again, Andy.
Good afternoon.
You've been, I'm sure, keeping track of the tracking polls there in New Hampshire. What do they show?
Well, we're seeing exactly what we saw in Iowa about a week ago, where Dean support is just plummeting. His support after Iowa has disappeared, and it's gone directly to Kerry. Neither Clark, Edwards, or Lieberman are really getting any of the effect of the Dean drop. It's all going to Kerry.
How reliable are these numbers?
I think they're more reliable when you poll in a primary state than you do in a caucus state, simply because the turnout in New Hampshire is much more like a general election than a caucus.
And is this, this fluidity that you're seeing, is this, do you think, likely to continue over the weekend, or is this firming up?
Well, I think it's going to continue for another day or two in the tracking polls, because we're still seeing people react to what happened in Iowa and to that speech, which I think Joe is right. That really crystallized a lot of the concerns that voters here had about Howard Dean's the real credibility or the trustworthiness he has as a potential president. I think the polling numbers are going to firm up a little bit. Dean's drop, though, is still pretty dramatic. He's losing support among his most loyal supporters, liberal Democrats, high income, and highly educated people here in the state, and they're going directly to Kerry.
And we've seen, I don't know how confident you want to be, Andy, but we've seen reports that Senator Kerry, some tracking polls, put him in the lead.
We'll be having him in the lead this evening. I think that it's going to continue to grow for a little bit.
How many people were undecided before the result of the Iowa caucuses, and where are those voters going?
We haven't seen any real change in the terms of undecided. They were 6% before. We're at about 7% now. So it's not changed that much. What we've really seen after Iowa is that drop of support for Dean is going right to Kerry. I don't see any other way to spin that here, except that Kerry has always been the number two guy in New Hampshire. His favorability ratings have always been right behind Dean's. He's been the number two choice for Dean supporters. So once they've decided that Dean was not their guy, they're going back to Kerry, who is their backup position.
Joe Klein, a big difference in New Hampshire is that independents, or I think undeclareds, as they call them there, are eligible to vote in the Democratic primary. How does that change things?
Well, you know, your next guest, Joe Lieberman, wants to believe that they'll help him, and that those voters aren't being picked up in these polls, or at least being undervalued in these polls. Last time, the independents were what really made the John McCain phenomenon when he trounced George W. Bush. He actually lost against among registered Republicans, if I remember correctly, and won that election on the basis of independents.
Andrew Smith, do the polls break down the independent voters?
Yeah, we look at those undeclared voters here. Kerry is still doing will be leading among undeclared voters when we release later on today. Kerry does better among registered Democrats, but when you look at Joe Lieberman specifically, he does slightly better among the undeclared voters, but not appreciably. He's still in single digits in the numbers that we're tracking.
So he would be in that, by my calculations then, what, third or fourth?
Fifth. He's behind Edwards here.
Joe Klein, Senator Lieberman, as you mentioned, is going to be with us in a few minutes. You followed his campaign along with all of the others. What is he trying to do? How well do you think he's doing it?
Well, I think that he's trying to pose himself as the new Democrat, the moderate Democrat candidate in a field that has, and in a party that has moved appreciably to the left. he's doing it in a very solid, credible way. I mean, this guy, if you talk about, you know, people who have the credentials and intelligence and disposition to be president, he's right up there. His problem is that he is in a much different place from the rest of the Democratic Party now, which expresses far greater doubts about the war in Iraq than he does. And and the other problem that he has, he alluded to it in the clip that you used at the top of the show. This is a very secular party, especially compared to the Republicans, and it's a party that reacts against broad statements of religiosity, big juicy evangelical statements that you hear from the other side of the political spectrum, and Joe Lieberman brings his faith very much into his campaign and very much into his persona, and that grates on a lot of Democrats.
As you mentioned, we're expecting him to join us in about 5 minutes' time from now. In the meantime, if you'd like to join the conversation and have a question for Senator Lieberman, our phone number is 800-989-8255, or email us, TOTN@npr.org. In the meantime, we have a general question about the race. This is Ken, who's on the phone from Niagara Falls in New York.
Hi. Yes,
First
of all, I'm a Dean supporter, and I'm even more of a Dean supporter since the Iowa speech that everybody's ragging on him about. Don't you think that my theory is that so much of the press has given him such negative publicity because they have a vested interest in this Democratic race being a horse race? And I mean, if Dean were to have continued just, to walk away with it, their ratings wouldn't have been as good as it was.
Joe Klein, I guess that's to you.
Well, the Democratic race is a horse race. It is a wide open race. But you cannot argue with 82% of Iowans who, last I checked, were pretty independent folks. And they took a good look at Howard Dean over the last two or three weeks and made a judgment based on his temperament.
I'm not arguing with 82% of Iowans. I'm arguing with 90% of the press that really doesn't give Howard Dean any kind of they just keep slamming him. They're not giving him any kind of. They're not being fair and balanced.
Ken, that's a curious phrase, but Ken, don't you think it's the role of the press in an election year, particularly to look out at the record of whichever candidate seems to be the front runner?
Well, yes, but it's continued even after he technically lost Iowa, and I mean it's gotten even worse. I mean USA Today yesterday. They referred to Dr. Dean and Mrs. Hyde. It was still very negative. Yeah. This whole thing.
Well, there's
so obvious.
I've been doing this for 30 some odd years, more than I'd like to remember, and I've rarely seen a moment comparable to the one on Monday night. I mean, you're running for president of the United States, most powerful person in the world, and that image that came across the tube, even most Democrats, many, many supporters of Dr. Dean feel. I mean, all you have to do is go to the Dean blog, and you'll find that over the first 48 hours or so, about 50% of the postings were expressing horror at this. Now, I'm a columnist. I'm allowed to have opinions. I agreed with Dean's position on the war and a number of the other things that he did, and I think that he remains the most direct, most...
I'm sorry, Ken. Anyway, we're running out of time in this segment. Wanted to thank you very much for the call.
One comment that if I could make about that, I don't think the press put Howard Dean on the stage and had him say those things. He did that on his own.
Hi, I'm back.
Okay. In any case, just in time for me to say thanks very much, Joe Klein.
Okay.
Joe Klein, a senior writer for Time magazine. Andrew Smith, we appreciate your time today, too. Andrew Smith, a professor of political science and director of the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire. Joe Klein was at our production facility in Manchester, and we spoke with Andy Smith at his office in Durham, North New Hampshire. When we come back from the break, Senator Joe Lieberman joins us. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and joining us now on the phone from Manchester, New Hampshire, is the Democratic presidential candidate, Senator Joe Lieberman. He participated in NPR's radio-only debate in Des Moines, Iowa. And Senator Lieberman, nice to talk to you again.
Neil, nice to be back with you. That was one of the high points of the campaign so far.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, it really was. It was a very good exchange, and I appreciated it.
Well, it's been a very eventful week in this race, and let me start out by asking, when you started out in the campaign, was this the scenario that you imagined, if things played out the way you thought they would?
Well, it's very interesting, and of course, this is a very undecided race, but I was thinking about it the other day because when we started out in the campaign, our assumption, mine was, that Dick Gephardt would win Iowa, that John Kerry would win New Hampshire, that I'd start in New Hampshire and do better than expected and then go on to February 3rd. The point now is that Howard Dean looked like he was going to win both and didn't in Iowa. And so this is a wide-open race. The important thing for me is that I'm running for a reason, that I have a set of principles and ideas and experiences that I've brought in after 30 years. I'm promising the American people that as president, I will do the right thing for them. I'm not going to yield to special interests or ideological extremists. I'm going to bring people together to get things done. And that hasn't changed at all. And I'm getting a very good reaction to that here in New Hampshire, where I still intend to do what was my goal at the outset of the year, which is to do better than expected.
Better than expected. We were just speaking with Andy Smith at the University of New Hampshire. He's doing the tracking polls. And again, these polls, as we've all learned in the last week, have a habit of changing quickly. But at the moment, he's got you listed at fifth.
Right.
Is that better than expected?
Well, I'm going to do better than that on election day, on primary day.
Okay.
That's the point. And I must tell you, I've been out again today. I just did a tour of a popular restaurant here, the Puritan in Manchester. And I just got great reactions, and quite specific, not just friendly, but we think you're the honest candidate. We know we can trust you. We appreciate your standing by your convictions. We're going to vote for you. So in the end, fortunately for our democracy, it's not the pollsters who pick presidents. It is the people.
Here's an email we have from Frank Leffler in Washington, D.C. I'm a disenchanted Republican thinking of switching my political affiliation, he writes. I've been following the Democratic race for a couple of months now, but being new to the party, I'm having difficulty differentiating between the candidates. Well, what are the major differences between you and the other hopefuls? Why should somebody support you and not one of the others?
Well, one, I have a 30-year record, which should give anyone thinking about voting here confidence about what kind of leader I would be. And my record is all about, one, overcoming polarization, division, which is a real problem in our country today. Two, doing what I believe is right for the country and not playing politics. Look, in this campaign, I'm the only one who has consistently said that America would be safer with Saddam Hussein in prison instead of in power. I still believe that. I'm the only Democrat who's been for middle-class tax cuts, and unlike the fiscally responsible Bush administration, I'm going to pay for them by raising taxes on higher-income Americans. So I've got a record which should lead a voter to conclude that, one, I'm a centrist, unlike George Bush, who's unfortunately governed from the far right. Two, I can bring people together for that reason. Three, I can win because I can appeal to and receive the support not only of Democrats but independents and disgruntled Republicans like Mr. Leffler. And four, I've got some great ideas for the future about cutting taxes, making health insurance affordable, rebuilding our alliances in the world, getting back to environmental protection, dealing with the health insurance crisis. So that's the combination: experience, integrity, ideas for the future, reliability at a very serious moment in our nation's history.
Let's get some callers involved if you'd like to pose a question to Senator Lieberman. Our number is 800-989-8255, and we'll begin with Donald, who joins us from Bernie, Texas.
Oh, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Senator Lieberman.
Yes, sir.
I'd like you to briefly touch on a subject which I'm sure is you've beaten to death in the past, but your endorsement of the ability for corporations not to expense options.
Yeah.
And that has been cited by many as setting up such a perverse motivation to make a number on the part of management.
Right.
Many have implicitly blamed the Enron debacles on that type of financial instrument. Would you care to comment, sir?
Yeah. I mean, the Enron debacles and the other corporate crimes that were committed are not the result of stock options. They're the result of executives who were greedy and did things that were unethical and then ultimately illegal. And you look at my record, I've been very strong on cracking down on that kind of corporate crime. But to go back to stock options were a great idea that were abused. Now, stock options helped 7 to 10 million Americans, most of them working people, middle-class people, to get a piece of the companies that they worked for. What was proposed back in the early 90s, I think, would have ended stock options and would have really hurt the opportunity for people to be worth something who were working hard for companies. Now, look, I watched what happened in some of these cases, and I came up with a stock option reform proposal of my own, which I think is really the best around, and it would say that a company can't give stock options to executives unless all the shareholders get a chance to vote on it. That stock options, we want to create tax incentives so that stock options will be given by a company to the majority of employees who are not the top five executives. And finally, I propose that we prohibit the kind of quick in-and-out exercising of stock options by company executives to make it much less likely, hopefully impossible, for some of the corporate crimes that existed in Enron and other cases. What I mean to say is that they wouldn't be able to exercise their options until they left the company. And I think in that way we could preserve what's good about this very democratic kind of capitalism that's helped millions get into the middle class and beyond and still deter the wrongdoing that occurred.
Donald, a brief follow-up.
Yes, sir. I think that you do misstate the fact that it democratizes capitalism. If companies aren't forced to expense them, then it's a freebie, which they are then able to give to key, in that case, key employees. When back in '94, you fought the FASB standards.
Yeah, and let me just say it again. I didn't want to get into the economics of it, but here's my point very briefly, that to expense an option at the time it's granted, which means when somebody gets it, there's no real value for it. And unfortunately, the Enron employees know that. Because if it was expensed at that time, it would be worth what the stock was selling for at that time.
So that's not the case.
A lot of them ended up with stock that was worthless. So, you know, I remained, and the company said that the more that they had to expense, the less that they would issue options. The reason I say democratic capitalism is that the fact is, and it's undeniable, that millions of middle-class Americans got stock options. The problem is that too great a percentage of the options went to the few people at the very top, and that's where my stock option reform proposal is meant to curb those excesses.
Email question from Ellen. Senator Lieberman, she writes, you've defended your position on Iraq and the ousting of Saddam Hussein. How do you defend the timing and the expense, both in American and Iraqi lives, as well as in American dollars, of the Iraq war, particularly when Osama bin Laden, the known mastermind of the September the 11th attacks, is still on the run?
Yeah. Unfortunately, when you're the commander-in-chief of the United States, you have to deal with more than one threat to our security at a given time. I decided, along with John McCain, long before George Bush became president, that Saddam Hussein was a danger, a homicidal maniac who killed hundreds of thousands of his own people, stifled their liberty, invaded two of his neighbors, wanted to be the dominant power in the Arab world, and according to the conclusion during the Clinton administration, tried to assassinate former President Bush. This was a man who would have caused incalculable additional loss of life to the American people if he remained in power. So when George Bush came along and sought to carry out the policy that McCain and I put in law to change the regime in Baghdad, I didn't think it was reasonable for me to oppose it because the president happened to be of another party. I'm from a tradition in American government where whenever you can, on matters of foreign and defense policy, particularly when American troops are on the line, you forget your partisanship. And I do feel very strongly that, one, the world is safer with Saddam Hussein in prison. Two, it has been a step forward in the war against terrorism because he was working with terrorists. And three, we have an extraordinary opportunity now in Iraq to build a stable, modernizing, democratizing country, in a great Arab country of great historical significance, Islamic country, that will send a message to the rest of the Islamic world that this is a better way to go, to live a better life, than turning to Al-Qaeda with all its hate and death. And therefore, look, I'm very critical of what the Bush administration did to make the case for the war before the war. I'm very critical of what the Bush administration did afterward in not having a real plan about how to secure the victory our military won. But are we safer today as a result of Saddam Hussein being out of power? Have we advanced our cause in the war against terrorism? Yes. Is there still work to do to get Osama and al-Qaeda? Yes, absolutely. Do we have to do more to extend, build bridges to the majority in the Islamic world? Of course. I mean, that's why I proposed to lead as president an international Marshall Plan for the Muslim world.
Let's get a caller on, and this is Bill, who's with us from Berkeley, California.
Thank you. Eleanor Roosevelt, in her last book, Tomorrow Is Now, urged the U.S. to make the United Nations the foundation of our U.S. foreign policy. I don't believe we've done that yet. What about your position on this? If you became president, would the U.N. become any more of a foundation? It certainly isn't now.
Certainly more than, thanks for the question, certainly more than under the Bush administration. Look, I'm a believer that the best kind of action is international action when you're dealing with an international problem. There are obviously times when for reasons of principle or security, you decide that you can't do that. And you know, President Clinton did not go to the United Nations before he took action in the Balkans to stop the aggression and genocide of Milosevic. And, of course, I think that was the right thing to do. In this administration, many of us who supported the war against Saddam pushed the administration to go to the United Nations. And that's why the resolution was passed in the Security Council. But unfortunately, when the resolution was not obeyed by Saddam Hussein, the members were not prepared to take action to enforce it. And so, unfortunately, individual members had to do that. But
Senator,
count on me to support the United Nations, to work through it. It needs to be modernized. But look, I always say if the United Nations didn't exist, we would want to create it because it is that important.
Senator Lieberman, if you just let me interject, I mean, a lot of people said the United Nations Security Council was not willing to go along because they saw no imminent threat from Saddam Hussein to his neighbors or to the United States. There has been no discovery of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq since the end of the war. We'll have more about that later in the program. But given that, was this a war of choice? Should the president have waited for approval by the Security Council?
Yeah, I think that, in fact, there were some very clear demands laid down that did not go specifically or implied imminent threat, which Saddam never obeyed. And I will to this day never understand why he didn't. Remember, Saddam told the United Nations inspectors in the 1990s that he had enormous quantities of chemical and biological weapons. In fact, the UN inspectors found some and destroyed them. Up until early last year, actually right before the war against Saddam, the United Nations inspector, team leader, the French, the Germans, everyone assumed, thought that he had weapons of mass destruction, and he would not tell the UN and the Security Council how he complied, what he did with those weapons, because he still had them. Now, why we haven't found them, that obviously is very troubling and a puzzle. I have no doubt. We know that he had them in the 90s by his own declaration.
Mm-hmm.
Where they are now, I think time will only tell. And, of course, we, as I've said before, have a responsibility to go back and ask our intelligence services what was the basis of the contentions that they were making prior to the war. But I want to say one final word on this, Neil. Throughout the years, now more than a decade, in which I felt that a change of regime in Baghdad was critically important to the freedom of the Iraqis, the security of the United States of America, I have always said that the reason I did was because of Saddam himself, a brutal, aggressive dictator. The weapons of mass destruction, for me, were part of the case, but a subsidiary case to the threat that this individual himself represented.
We're speaking with Senator Joe Lieberman, a candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. Molly joins us on the line from Pontiac, Michigan.
Yes, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Senator Lieberman.
Good afternoon to you, Molly.
I actually have a comment that I would like to make. I'm not very well versed in politics, but I am an intelligent woman. I am a small business owner.
Yes.
And I wanted to make a comment because I feel that you are truly a man of integrity and honesty. And I believe that when you start with a solid base, regardless of the obstacles that you face, when you have that solid foundation, you can approach each one of the problems that you will be facing with the right state of mind. And I think that our presidency, the office of the presidency, has lost a great deal of respect and dignity, which I think you could bring back to the office. And I also believe that in the eyes of the rest of the world, America has certainly faltered.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame. You know, I was a professional ballet dancer, and we're always taught that if your base is strong, you can handle anything. And this is how I feel about you as a candidate. You have a strong base, and I'm just I've always voted the man, and I will be voting for you.
I wish I was there because I'd jump up and give you a warm hug.
I was just going to say I didn't know you had any relatives in Michigan, Senator.
Yeah, no, we have not met each other, have we?
No.
I'm very touched by what you said, and I must say that I've been saying to people here in New Hampshire that the positions we take on the different issues, healthcare, the economy, the environment, war, are all obviously very important, but ultimately,
absolutely,
I think the judgment is, who is the person running? Does he or she, do they know who they are, and can you rely on them to both level with the American people and genuinely try to decide what's right for the country, not for the party, not for the interest groups, and then do it? And I'm very touched by what you said, and it will encourage me in the next few days on our way to the New Hampshire primary. Thank you.
Well, please do. Please remain encouraged, because I certainly am going to encourage the people that I'm familiar with to vote.
Good. Call any friends or relatives you have in New Hampshire.
I was going to say, how long does it take to establish residence there?
I think it's a little late. Thank you. take care.
Thank you so much.
Molly, thank you very much for the call. And Senator Lieberman, we know your schedule is very crowded ahead of the critical debate tonight and the primary on Tuesday. We thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Neil, always good to be with you. Good questions, good conversation. I look forward to being back soon.
Senator Joe Lieberman, the Democrat from Connecticut. He is a candidate for President of the United States, running for the Democratic nomination. He joined us on the phone from New Hampshire. When we come back from a short break, BBC reporter Jane Corbin joins us to talk about a new PBS documentary that airs tonight. It follows the U.S. team searching for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.